enough to remember the early 1990s will no doubt know who Kurt Cobain is. Musician, songwriter, and artist, Cobain was the frontman of the hugely popular grunge band Nirvana. The band, by 1993, had sold over 47 million worldwide album sales, making them one of the biggest bands of their day. Then it all came to a crash and an abrupt end when the body of Cobain was found at his Seattle home. But what actually happened? This is the mysterious death of Kurt Cobain. We all know the official narrative. Kurt died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head after taking a massive overdose of heroin. He had been missing for around a week after escaping from a Los Angeles rehab facility and flying back to his home city of Seattle. Whilst that is the official story, there are other variations of possibility. There are strange elements of the story that doesn't quite make sense or add up. There are unanswered questions, and there are proven falsities and inconsistencies that make the events surrounding Cobain's death mysterious and very suspicious. So who was the real Kurt Cobain? The 2015 documentary directed by Brett Morgan, Montage of Heck, portrays a troubled Cobain with a genius brain, who spent his younger years looking for inclusion and love, and his adult years extremely depressed, suicidal, and melancholy. Unfortunately, most of Montage of Heck is complete fabrication. A rose-tinted view of Cobain's life portrayed to fit the legend of Cobain by his wife Courtney Love. Love was heavily involved in the direction and narrative of the documentary, and Love's daughter Frances Bean was the picture's executive producer. The reason I mention this will become apparent later on. Friends and those who knew Cobain told that he was intelligent, sarcastic, funny, and was not at all suicidal in any point during his life. Cobain would often reply when asked how he was with, "I hate myself and I want to die," a response he found dryly humorous. This was also the intended original title of Nirvana's third studio album, In Utero, which was changed prior to the release by Cobain. After the release of In Utero, Rolling Stone magazine asked him about the original title, to which Cobain confirmed that it was as literal as a joke as could be. He continued that it was a direct reference to the far-from-the-truth public perception of him being this pissy, complaining, freaked-out schizophrenic who wants to kill himself all the time. Cobain was heavily into drugs. Having first tried marijuana in 1980 at the age of 13, he progressed onto LSD, alcohol, solvents, and eventually heroin. He would often complain of an undiagnosed stomach pain and state that the drugs he took were the only things that made the pain go away. The stomach complaint was not a real condition, however. It was a way that Cobain could remove both his self-guilt and also the judgment of others while he consumed his narcotic of choice. Observers will defend the stomach pain comments by saying that he frequently vomited, but longtime friend Buzz Osborne of the punk band The Melvins said that, of course he was vomiting. That's what people on heroin do. They vomit. It's called vomiting with a smile on your face. Cobain had been taking heroin sporadically since 1986, but by 1990 he had developed a serious addiction. By the end of his life in 1994, he was consuming a $400 a day habit, which is no small amount. While the media image of Cobain falls far from who he actually was, this was actually fueled by Cobain himself. By rarely giving honest answers during interviews, and often his dry humor would be misunderstood or taken out of context, giving the impression of a depressed, negative, and miserable individual who bore dark thoughts and was extremely unhappy. Whilst Kurt did suffer from depression, he was also a typical Generation Xer, and youth culture of the early 90s was also particularly negative and surly, stemming from a direct reaction to the over-the-top excess and happiness of the 1980s. Cobain's attitude, humour and demeanour were no different to his bandmates at the time and peers within the punk community. On January 12, 1990, Cobain met Courtney Love at the Satricon nightclub in Portland. Initially, even though he was attracted to her, he rebuffed her advances as he wanted to remain single for a period. However, after a month of advances from Love, Cobain eventually gave in to his feelings and they began dating. They were married on February 24, 1992 in Hawaii, with Love already pregnant, although unaware, with their daughter Frances Bean. It's worth noting at this point that throughout Cobain's life, it was never reported that he was suicidal. Courtney Love never said that he was ever suicidal, and Kurt never, in seriousness, vocalized that he was unhappy. Quite the contrary, actually. After the birth of his daughter, Frances, friends said he was a doting father and spent as much time as he could with his child. Surely this was a reason alone for fulfillment. What is no secret is that Cobain had grown weary of his relationship with Love. She was abusive, controlling and manipulative, and Cobain had stated that he was making plans to divorce her. What is fact here is that Cobain and Love had a prenuptial agreement. This was signed at the insistence of Love prior to their wedding. On March 3, 1994, Cobain was hospitalized and in a coma in Rome. It was the result of an overdose of alcohol and painkillers. His management company at the time stated that he had been suffering from bronchitis and laryngitis and accidentally taken too much pain medication. After Cobain's death, weeks later, Courtney Love stated that the Rome incident was Cobain's first suicide attempt, that he had taken over 50 Rohypnol pills and champagne, which caused the overdose. However, this was not claimed by Love at the time Cobain was in a coma, or in the 7 weeks between the Rome incident and his actual death. Dr. Oswaldo Giletta, who treated Cobain in Rome, stated, however, that it was not a suicide attempt at all, and that he can tell when such an attempt is made. He also denied Love's comments that 50 Rohypnol pills had been ingested by Cobain. On March 25, 1994, Love arranged for an intervention for Cobain at their Seattle home. Friends, record company executives, Love and Cobain's closest friend Dylan Carlson tried to convince Cobain to go to rehab and kick his habits. Initially, Cobain reacted abusively towards the group, but eventually agreed to attend a detox program. Cobain was admitted to the Exodus Recovery Center in Los Angeles on March 30, 1994. The following night, while popping outside for a cigarette, he scaled a 6-foot-high perimeter wall and made his way to Los Angeles International Airport. The missing week. Kurt Cobain purchased a one-way ticket to Seattle using his personal credit card on the 1st of April 1994. On the flight, he sat next to Guns N' Roses bassist Duff McKagan, who later said that Cobain seemed really happy. Once they landed in Seattle, the two musicians went their separate ways, although McKagan would later go on to say, "I knew from all my instincts that something was wrong." Several eyewitnesses reported that they saw Cobain around Seattle on the days of the 2nd and 3rd of April. On April 8th, Gary Smith, an electrician hired to install a security system at Cobain and Love's Lake Washington Boulevard property, discovered Cobain's dead body and alerted the police. The coroner's report would later estimate that Cobain's body had been lying there without life since April 5th. Kurt Cobain was found to have a high concentration of heroin and diazepam in his system, and had also suffered a shotgun blast through his mouth. But let's take a step back. After Cobain went missing from the detox facility, Love was alerted to his disappearance by those responsible for him there. She contacted a Los Angeles private investigator and former LAPD officer Tom Grant to aid in locating Cobain. Tom Grant believes that Cobain was murdered and that Love had a part to play. To support this, he has stated that the 1.52 milligrams per liter of morphine in Kurt's blood, a byproduct of heroin in the bloodstream, was over 3 times a fatal dose. So if Kurt had taken this amount via injection, he would have almost immediately been incapacitated by the drug and therefore unable to fire the shotgun and kill himself. Even an individual with a high tolerance to heroin, as Kurt likely had, would have found this volume of morphine overwhelming and fatal. Grant also finds Cobain's suicide note highly suspicious. Grant states that the note is clearly a farewell from Cobain to his fans and Love as an indication of him leaving Nirvana and the music industry. Later, Dave Grohl and Chris Novoselic would confirm that Nirvana was all but over at this point and about to break up. Grant asserts that the several lines at the bottom of the note are the only parts referring to suicide and are written in someone else's hand. In fact, Rosemary Carroll, the lawyer for Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love, has stated that she saw a practice sheet belonging to Love that appears to be evidence of Love trying to forge Cobain's handwriting. During the time that Tom Grant was hired by Love to find Cobain, Love stated that she had planted a story with the press that she had overdosed on drugs and was at the hospital. This was in the hope that Cobain would see this and try to contact her. However, this was unsuccessful. She then filed a missing persons report under the name Wendy O'Connor, Kurt's mother's name. At this point, Grant alleges, Love didn't want any surveillance at their Lake Washington house, as their nanny for Francis Bean was there. Michael DeWitt, or Callie to friends, was a former boyfriend of Love's, and Grant states that Love said he would tell her if Cobain showed up. On April 6, Grant persuaded Love to allow him to travel to Seattle to search for Cobain and coordinate things there. When he arrived, he met up with Kurt's best friend Dylan Carlson, who aided Grant in his search for Cobain. Carlson told Grant in response to questioning that Kurt was in no way suicidal. Both Carlson and Grant searched the Cobain/Love residence for Kurt but found nothing. The next day, on April 7th, after Carlson and Grant had searched a number of local motels, Carlson called Love to check in. She asked Carlson and Grant to go back to their house and search again, this time to look for a shotgun that Kurt might have that Carlson had purchased for him sometime before. When they arrived at the house, they found a note on the stairs that was not present the day before. It was from Callie and addressed to Kurt. It was urging Kurt to contact Courtney and let her know where he was. It stated she was worried and in the hospital after having an accident. It urged Kurt to get his act together for the sake of his daughter. Tom Grant felt the letter was fake, placed there by Callie, but for alternate reasons. Grant would later call the Cobain lawyers Rosemary Carroll to discuss the letter, and she agreed that the letter seemed fake. She commented that Callie had placed it there because he knew Kurt was dead. The following morning, the body of Cobain was found. It was found in a storage room above the greenhouse at Cobain and Love's residence. Grant had not been notified of the existence of this room, nor indicated by Carlson or Love that the room existed and needed to be checked. When Gary Smith, the electrician, found Cobain's body, he called the police immediately. When police arrived, they found the door locked and Cobain lay on his back with his shotgun resting on his chest. The suicide note he wrote was by the side of his body. Many reports state that the greenhouse door was locked from the inside, but this is inaccurate. It could be locked from either side. Reports also state that Cobain had left his driving license next to his body so that he could be identified when found. However, this was taken from a wallet by the first police officers on the scene and left next to his body for photographic reasons. There was very little blood around the body of Cobain. This is consistent with shotgun blast through the mouth with that caliber of rifle. When the police found Cobain's body, the shotgun was held upside down in Cobain's left hand. His hand and body was in a state of cadaver spasm, where at the point of death the muscles freeze, retaining the point of death position. The problem with this, however, is that the shell that was ejected from the rifle was found across the room to Cobain's left-hand side, while the exit chamber of the shotgun was on the right-hand side. This meant that the shell, if Cobain had shot himself, should have been to the right-hand side of the room, but it wasn't. Several weeks before Cobain's death, Rosemary Carroll states that Love had contacted her and stated that Cobain was going to divorce her and asked for help in finding the meanest, nastiest divorce lawyer that she could. She also stated that Love inquired as to whether there was a way that the prenuptial agreement could be disregarded during the divorce. At the same time this happened, on March 1, 1994, Cobain also contacted Carroll from Germany, asking for her help in removing Love from his last will and testament. 2 days later, he overdosed in Rome. Rosemary Carroll later asked Grant why he didn't find Cobain's body 2 days earlier when him and Carlson first searched the house. Grant stated that he didn't even know the greenhouse existed, as it was not visible in the dark. Rosemary then confirmed that she personally witnessed a telephone conversation between Love and Carlson that day, where Love told Carlson to check the greenhouse specifically, but Carlson never mentioned this to Grant. In fact, after Cobain's body was found, Carlson told Grant that Love never asked him to check the greenhouse at all. Also worth noting is that a few hours before Cobain's body was found, someone attempted to buy $43 worth of flowers using Kurt's credit card. The credit card, of course, was known to have been with Kurt, as he had bought his ticket back to Seattle using the card several days earlier. When the card was used, Kurt had been dead for 3 days. The card, however, was never found, nor was the person who attempted to use it. Tom Grant is adamant that he does not believe that a conspiracy or cover-up by the Seattle Police Department took place. However, he has stated that police officers may have been influenced in their outcome decision of suicide by reports filed by Courtney Love, where she stated that Cobain had escaped a rehab facility, bought a shotgun, and may be suicidal. Media misinformation. There were several elements of fake news and rumors in the days after Cobain's death. Initially, it was reported that Kurt Cobain's face was unidentifiable after the shotgun blast. This, however, was incorrect. John Fisk, the first paramedic on the scene, stated that no damage was done to Cobain's face, and he doesn't know where this rumor came from. That caliber of rifle, shot into the mouth, rarely causes structure damage to the rest of the head. What is accurate and strange, however, is that the shotgun did not contain any identifiable fingerprints. Further rumors appeared in the press at the time, including an excerpt from Kurt's suicide note that read, "I can't live my life like this any longer." This wasn't actually in the suicide note, however, and only Love and Grant had a copy of the suicide note at the time, so this rumor had to come from Love. The suicide note talks mainly about Kurt's involvement in the music industry and is addressed to Bodda, Kurt's childhood imaginary friend. Then for the last three lines, in different handwriting, it briefly refers to his family and now appears to be addressing Courtney. For those conspiracy theorists out there, the following is also worth taking into consideration. A man by the name of Eldon Hoke, known in LA punk circles as El Duce, and who was the singer for the punk band The Mentors, claims he was offered $50,000 in December 1993 by Courtney Love to kill Kurt Cobain by blowing his head off and making it look like a suicide. This story is corroborated by Karush Subdian, who was present and witnessed the exchange. El Duce accepted the offer at the time, however a few months later when Love contacted him, he was on tour with the Mentors and was not able to help her. In 1997, El Duce took part in an interview with British documentary filmmaker Nick Broomfield. He confirmed that the offer that was made to him by Love was true. During the interview, he also stated that whilst he wasn't able to commit the murder, he knew who did. Additionally, he accidentally let slip the first name of the man who had supposedly committed the act. The name that slipped out during the interview was Alan. Alan Wrench, a member of LA punk band Road Whore. Supposedly, a week after the Broomfield interview, Alan turned up at El Duce's house and the two got into a heated argument. Later that night, El Duce was struck and killed by a train in strange circumstances. Following Cobain's death, eyewitnesses noted that Alan came into enough money to buy a house with two cars, whereas before he was not that well off. Tom Grant has stated that Edward Gelb, the top polygraph expert in the US, was brought in to perform a lie detector test with El Duce in March 1996. He confirmed with a 99.1% accuracy rate that El Duce was indeed telling the truth. All of this is alleged, however, and I let you make up your own minds on this one. Following Kurt Cobain's death, there has been 68 copycat suicides to date by Kurt Cobain and Nirvana fans. Whilst Nirvana's musical legacy lives on, and Cobain's art is still prevalent today, the legacy of suicide also hangs over the image of Cobain. Misunderstood by most, whatever your thoughts on the strange death of Kurt Cobain, he was quite possibly the last true rock star of our time. Finally, here is something to leave you with. On May 25th, 2018, Isaiah Silver, the ex-husband of Frances Bean Cobain, filed a lawsuit in the Superior Court of California. He alleges that Courtney Love, with accomplices, attempted to persuade friends of Silver that he was suicidal and contemplating death. Silver also alleges that accomplices of Love invaded his home, threatened him, beat him, kidnapped him, and threatened to kill him. Finally, Silver alleges that Wendy O'Connor, Kurt Cobain's mother, believes that Love had something to do with the murder of Kurt Cobain. Take care of yourself, everyone, and be kind to one another. And remember, stand firm and hold fast as you enter the darkest night. Hey everyone, before you head off, I just wanted to say a huge thank you for all the support I've received recently in regards to our little podcast. It's been really humbling. If you can, please follow us on Twitter, which is twitter.com/deadsoulscast. Also our Instagram page, which is dead_souls_podcast. And finally, check out our Patreon if you'd like to support our dark little podcast. Please head over to patreon.com/deadsouls. I'm Jamie Black. Good night, everyone.